I was very excited when I found out that I was preaching during Christmas, and I thought that's so kind of Ruan to give me a nice Christmas passage to preach on. I thought, will it be the shepherds with the angels in the sky? Will it be the wise men with their gifts? Will it be maybe baby Jesus being presented in the temple to Simeon and Anna? And then I looked up today's passage, and I saw I was blessed to speak on what has traditionally been called the Massacre of the Innocents. So I'm wondering why Ruan took this Sunday off. So you may be wondering what a story like this is doing inside the story of Christmas. So let's see what it has to teach us. So our story starts, Matthew 2, 13 to 23. It starts just after the visit of the Magi, the wise men from the East. And we'll be looking at the story of the Magi next week at the start of Epiphany. The passage starts with an angel who speaks to Joseph through a dream. If you have read the passages around it, you'll see that this is something that happens to Joseph quite frequently, that an angel speaks to him through a dream. And Joseph is warned to flee to Egypt because Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. So you might remember the story that happens before of the Magi. It's from them that this king, Herod the Great, hears that a king of the Jews is going to be born in Bethlehem. And Herod is disturbed by this message because he is currently the ruling king of Judah, of Judea, and he would be aware of this ancient Jewish prophecy that one day a great ruler is going to arise, the great Messiah who would rise up, who would take his place on King David's throne, and who would rule over Israel. And Herod the Great is not about to let anyone take his power from him. From history, we know about Herod that he even had three of his own sons killed when he suspected that they were plotting to kill him and take his throne. So it is no surprise that Joseph, Mary, and Jesus are urged to flee from Bethlehem and from this murderous king. And the point is proved. They are proved to be right when Herod decides to not take any risk and to have all of the young boys of Bethlehem 2 years and under killed. Bethlehem would have been a small village, so we're probably talking about the murder of between 20 and 30 young boys, which would have undoubtedly been a colossal tragedy for the inhabitants of this village. And by this time, Jesus is in Egypt in safety. And so again, we know from historians that Herod the Great died around 1 BC, which is perhaps a year or two after Jesus was born, and that he split his kingdom up between three sons. Archelaus becomes the ruler of Judea and Samaria. You can see it on the map. That's where Bethlehem is, just south of Jerusalem. Philip becomes a ruler of a part of modern-day Syria, and Antipas rules over Galilee. Of these three, Archelaus has the worst reputation. His behavior is very similar to that of his father. So even though Joseph receives the message that it is safe to return to the land of Israel, he is cautioned against going back to the region of Bethlehem, where Archelaus reigns. And instead, he goes back to a town where he has previously lived, where he went before the census was, which is Nazareth, a very small town in Galilee. So what can we learn from this passage? Well, firstly, we can learn that nothing that happens in this story is outside of the sovereign control that God has over his world. Even though from the very beginning, Jesus and his family are being hunted down by those in power, none of this takes God by surprise. None of it threatens his plan. In fact, in a strange way, in a way we can't completely understand, it seems to be part of his plan. Look at the three prophecies that are fulfilled in the various stages in the passage that we read today. Firstly, after Jesus flees for Egypt, verse 15 says, "And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet." And when the baby boys of Bethlehem are killed, again it says, Then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. When the family moved to Nazareth, verse 23 says, again, so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets, that he would be called a Nazarene. Scholars altogether count around 300 prophecies from the Old Testament that are in some way fulfilled in the life of Jesus, which is really an astounding amount. There was a professor, an American professor of mathematics called Peter Stoner, who did a research into the likelihood of eight Old Testament prophecies, which matched most closely with the things Jesus did. What were the chances of these eight prophecies being fulfilled in the life of one person? And they found, this professor of mathematics, that the chance was 1 in 10 to the power of 17. This is the chance of only eight of these prophecies being fulfilled. He wrote this about these prophecies. Let us try to visualize this chance. If you mark 1 in 10 tickets, and you place all the tickets in a hat, and you thoroughly stir them, and then you ask a blindfolded man to draw one out, his chance of getting the right ticket is 1 in 10. But suppose now that we take 10 to the power of 17 silver dollars and lay them over the face of the state of Texas. They will come to a height of 2 feet deep throughout the whole state. Now mark one of these silver dollars and stir the mass all over the state. Then take a blindfolded man, tell him he can travel wherever he wants to, and he must pick up one silver dollar and say that it is the right one. What chance would he have of getting the right one? Just the same chance that the prophets would have had in writing these eight prophecies and having them all come true in any one man from their day to the present time, providing they wrote using their own wisdom. So, the conclusion of a professor of mathematics is that the only reasonable way that one person could fulfill only a fraction of the prophecies that Jesus did is if this person is in control of the very events. We may be thinking what great risks God is taking by allowing his son to be born into such difficult circumstances, but the authors of the Gospels know better. Every part of this story is a fulfillment of something that the Lord has prophesied. We may not always understand why these things happen, but we do know that they do not happen because God is not in control. In fact, the first two prophecies, in pointing backwards in time, also point forwards to what Jesus' mission on earth is. The first prophecy which is fulfilled is that Jesus has to flee to Egypt for a while. And then Matthew draws attention to the fact that this was already prophesied by the prophet Hosea. Namely, they both said, "Out of Egypt I called my son." If you were here a few weeks ago, you would have remembered that Ruin spoke about how prophecy works, about that fulfillment is often according to two horizons. Often the prophecy is fulfilled literally in the close proximity of when the prophecy was made, but very often as well it is fulfilled in the life of Jesus, so in a further horizon. And often, the fulfillment in Jesus' life is actually the way in which the prophecy really, really comes true. The greater fulfillment. So when Hosea says, "Out of Egypt I called my son," the readers of the Old Testament would have thought back to how God's beloved people, God's son Israel, was freed out of Egypt, out of slavery from the Egyptians. But Matthew then sees this as well as Jesus fulfilling the prophecy. And if I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but if you compare the stories of Moses, who leads the Israelites out of Egypt, and the story of Jesus' youth and birth, there are some striking similarities. In both stories, a troubled king gives the order to kill all the male children in the area where the child is born, because he has learned of the birth of Israel's liberator. Both infants are then protected and delivered from these rulers who seek to kill them. Both are then forced to leave their home country, and both are then later called back to their home country by God after the death of that king. So we have one prophecy which links Jesus to the Exodus, and sort of presents him as a greater Moses, someone who will lead his people out of slavery. Now, what you may be thinking is, how did Matthew make this link? Isn't it a bit sneaky that he takes this one verse, perhaps a little bit out of context, and suddenly applies it to Jesus? After all, the name Jesus is not mentioned in Hosea, or in fact anywhere in the Old Testament. So then we shall ask ourselves, what would Jesus have thought of the way that Matthew interpreted this verse? Well, fortunately, we do know what he would have thought. This is the story of when Jesus talks to his disciples on the road to Emmaus after he has risen from the dead. Luke 24, he says to them, to his disciples, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And then, beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all of the scriptures concerning himself. So Jesus is saying that all of the scriptures, Moses and the prophets, was a way of speaking about the scriptures. Remember, the scriptures at this time was only the Old Testament, because the New Testament had not been written yet. So all of the scriptures, Jesus is saying, reflects his story and has to do with him. So even Jesus himself interprets the Old Testament as being about him. So that was the first of those prophecies. And I also want to look at the second one. The second prophecy from our story is from Jeremiah 31:15. And this one is fulfilled when Herod commands the killing of these little boys. It's the same in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted because they are no more." So what is the context of why this was written in the Old Testament? That is the context of the other big event in the Old Testament. If one of the big events was the Exodus, the other big event was the exile to Babylon. Again, you might know the story. Israel and Judah have abandoned God. They are worshipping idols. They think that they no longer need God. They have moved away from him. And so God allows them to be taken away from their land, away also from his presence, which was in the temple, and away into exile in Babylon. As with the circumstances preceding the Exodus, this is also a moment when Israel are at their lowest, when there is no hope for them. They are away from their country. The temple has been destroyed. Their country has been ransacked by this foreign nation. There is no hope for them. And this prophecy speaks of the mothers who are weeping for their children who have been taken away into exile and who they will never see again. And again, in the same way that this prophecy spoke to the events of the exile, it also speaks to the events surrounding Jesus' birth as mothers mourn the loss of their children once again. And so, these are just examples from this passage, but as you read the story of Jesus, you see that again and again there are these connections to things that have happened in the Old Testament, prophecies that are fulfilled in Jesus. Throughout the Gospels, the themes of Exodus and exile are drawn out to show us that Jesus, whose name means God saves, is the one who will bring about a new exodus out of slavery, a new return from exile. And so we know that through the cross, we know more so than people at this time, we know that that is true, because through the cross we are set free from our slavery to the power of sin and death. And in fullness of time, we will also be set free from the very presence of sin and death. But we also know that through the cross, we have been reconciled with God. Peace has been made between God and us. We are forgiven, and so we are no longer spiritually in exile. We are no longer spiritually separated from God. He has brought us home. So, all of this is good, and all of this is true, but it leaves me with a question. What about those babies in Bethlehem? What about their parents? What about Joseph and Mary and the anxieties they had to go through, fleeing for their lives? Well, another thing that becomes clear from this story is this, that when Jesus comes to earth, all problems do not magically disappear. Though his name means God saves, though he does save, this does not mean that those Bethlehem families are spared their tragedy. And this is something that's important for us to wrestle with when we claim to be followers of a God who saves, and when our own questions of suffering and evil arise. So what does God say to us in those situations? And I think the answer to this lies in his other name. If his one name is Jesus, which means God saves, his other name is Emmanuel, God with us. Because of Christmas, we can know that God is with us because he was actually with us. When we think of God with us, we don't have to think of some ethereal being floating along on a cloud, cheering us on, but with no real sense of what it is like to be one of us. One of the reasons we can wholeheartedly believe in God's love for us is because he did the very real and the very hard thing of becoming one of us, and for no other reason than to be with us. So that means that when we suffer, when we experience tragedy, when we have questions that, to be perfectly honest, have no satisfactory answer, we can know that God himself knows what that is like. God himself knows what that is like. Just from the Christmas story, we learn that Jesus knows what it is like to grow up in poverty. He knows what it is like to have to fear for his life. He knows what it is like to be a refugee. He knows what it is like to have to flee from his home. From the rest of the Gospels, we know that Jesus knows what it is like to be betrayed by his friends. He knows what it is like to have a loved one die. He knows what it is like to be rejected, to be tired, to wonder why God has forsaken him. And also that he knows what it is like to experience joy, to have a party with his friends, to enjoy good food and friendship like we did at Christmas. In the Hebrews passage that Diana read for us, we read that he was fully human in every way. He was and he is God with us. The good news of the gospel is this, that God, out of his great love for us, came down from heaven, and in the most important way, he was God instead of us. In every way that matters, because he lived the perfect life of obedience to the Father that we should have lived. And he died the perfect death to pay for, finally and fully, for all of our sins that we deserved and that we should have died. In every way that matters, he was God instead of us. But the good news of the gospel is also this, that in all the other moments, we can know the comfort that he is God with us. Of course, we long for the day when he will return, when he will come to make all the wrong things right like he promised to, when all of death and all of suffering and all sadness will be swallowed up in victory. But until then, we may not always know the answer to our suffering, but we do know that it is not because God does not know what it is like, because he became fully human in every way. And it is not because he did not love us and does not love us, because he loved us so much that he entered into our experience. He shared our experience so that he would be able to be with us and so that we would not be alone. And ultimately, of course, he shared that experience so that he could end all pain and suffering without ending us. We can trust that in the resurrection on the last day, the pain and suffering of the little boys in the families of Bethlehem and our pain and all of the pain and suffering in this world will be transformed into everlasting joy. And how we look forward to that. So be encouraged because of Emmanuel, the God who is always with us. Amen. So let's take a moment to be quiet and to pray.